Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Welcome to session number 13. Actually, in some hotels in Poland, they avoid number 13 for the rooms, but we are not that strict here. So more important, the number of this session is the topic of the session, which is very exciting because it will be about, first of all, collaboration with scientific community. Secondly, communication to users, which seems to be very important. And I think the role of media will be touched, at least in some presentations. My name is Krzysztof Jajuga, and I'm chairing this session. I am with my connections to Statistics Poland, is I'm a member of the methodological committee for statistical office for Statistics Poland. I also chair the committee of statistics and econometrics for Polish Academy of Science. So without delay, I think we will start. Technical issues, there is 12 minutes for the presentation. I think that 2 minutes before the end, this is not a red card, this is yellow card, so okay, but you know, okay, that's light red maybe. And then we'll still have about half an hour, maybe a little bit less for the Q&As, questions and answers. So without undue delay, I would like to ask Ann-Marie Karlsson, Swedish Board of Agriculture. I think this is joint paper with your colleague. And title is Communicating Official Statistics and Its Quality in Blocks, a Rhetorical Analysis. So, floor is yours.
Thank you. I've written this paper together with a colleague of mine, Jonas Hammarstrand. And we at the Swedish Board of Agriculture are responsible for the official statistics in Sweden in the agricultural area. And we disseminate this, as you usually do, with statistical reports and with a database. And we link this dissemination with a quality declaration in accordance with, for example, the EU statistical law and the logo, Official Statistics of Sweden. But then we also have the blog. And the blog consists of text, diagrams, and pictures. It's about 300 words long, each blog post. And the sender is clearly the Swedish Board of Agriculture, but the tone is more personalized. It is, for example, signed with a name. And when you look a little bit of how it's used, we have, in the paper, we study a 3-year period, and then we can see that each year we have about 500 tables in the statistical reports, in 50 reports. We have 160 database tables, and for the databases, we can see that we have about 2,000 downloads each month. For the blog, we do 220 about blog posts each year, a little bit more than 2 a week. And we have about 17,000 clicks on each blog post each month. So as you can see, the blog is extensively used. And we use it in different ways, the blog. We use it to highlight when we have published the statistics. We use it more thematically so we can cover all aspects of a specific area. We try to publish posts when there is, for example, a discussion in society about the subject matter. We try to use the blog to tell about statistics that could be relevant for the matter. And we also try to explain misuse, for example, definitions. And in the paper, we discuss quite a lot in relation to the rhetorical situation as defined by Lloyd Bitzer in the 60s. But here I would just like to highlight perhaps what we see as the pressing problem in this context. And that is that we, as a statistical authority, has a legal obligation to make statistics available for the users. And in order to do that, of course, we have to disseminate the statistics, but we also have to let them know that the statistics exists and how it can be used in relation to their needs. So we see the blogs as like a third way of showing statistics for the users. And would also like to give you an example of our blog. And this is a Google Translate, so the English is a little funny, but you see what the blog looks like. And this is a blog post of the price for sugar, granulated sugar. And it's a long time series, which we usually have in the blog posts from the 60s up to now. And we present the figures both in current prices and in the 2012 price level. And then in the text usually has a fairly personal beginning. It's very fun to study long time series. Or I read in the newspaper yesterday about that the number of dairy cows are decreasing in Sweden, so I found it interesting to see if they were also decreasing in Denmark, for example. So it usually have that a little bit personalized beginning. I also give here a little hint about the quality, because I say that sugar is a product that has been pretty much the same for the past 60 years, so it's possible to look at the time series. In the text, I explain more or less what you see in the diagram. And then I give even more information about the periods when the prices have changed big. For example, in 94-95, when Sweden joined EU, we took over the EU agricultural policy for sugar, which meant that the import tariffs were higher. So that's why the price then went up in 1995. And then this price statistic come from Statistics Sweden, who have consumer price. Now I attach this to our own statistics about direct consumption of sugar. And then I sort of explain the definition of direct consumption. And once again, I explain in the text what you can see in the diagram. And finally, I give more information about the quality. I say that all sugar we eat is not included. There could be sugar in fruits, for example. And there are also some sweeteners that are not included. So for the matter of sugar here, you got quite a lot of information, both about the price and the consumption. We also studied meat consumption, which we have written quite a lot about during the period, because meat consumption has been discussed. And then we can see that we've had perhaps 6% of the tables in our reports about consumption is about meat, while 30% of our blog posts and 60% of the clicks are for meat consumption. So you can see that we in the blog both write more and it's more used by the users, the specific statistics that is especially interesting. So then if you look at the blog contribution towards the quality criteria, you can say that it is relevance, you can discuss the relevance for the users because you give them a small proportion thematically, usually when they want just that kind of information. So they got it sort of timely and when it's relevant for them. The statistics could be easily found because the blog is very Google friendly, so it's easy to find. And also we give quite a lot of explanations, so it's good for the less experienced users. But the minus is, of course, that it's very small proportion of the statistics that is really shown and perhaps not gives an accurate description of everything that could be relevant. When it comes to timeliness, we discussed that a little bit differently here because you could see that it is timeliness for the user because the statistics is highlighted at a time when they are interesting in these statistics. There might be a meat crisis about beef from Brasilia, then we describe how the import of beef is constructed, for example. So in that case, we can be high on timeliness. But of course, we can't blog up about anything that isn't officially disseminated. So it's still the time lag in the official statistics. And we can also see that when we study this three-year period, we respond rather quickly, but we are fairly seldom proactive of coming up with an area that might be interested for the users. Once again, accessibility and clarity, you get a small portion, which is described fairly clear. You have a third option, another way of looking at the statistics. You are on the web, where the users are. And we thought that mainly it would be experienced users that use these statistics, but we can also see that, for example, journalists are common users. They want to write about cows, for example, and then they Google cows, and then they come to the blog, and then usually we get a phone call that they want the data behind the statistics, or perhaps they want, if we show the statistics for whole of Sweden, perhaps they want the specific NUTS 3 region. But we can see that it is a port to get to know the statistics. But of course, that it is informal and that it is, the statistics is described in a little bit of another way than official statistics is usually described could also mean that it would be less clear for the users who are used to go to the database or more conventional statistical reports. Accuracy. In the blog, we can see when we studied the blog post for 3 years that we spend quite a lot of time describing the definitions and the circumstances around the statistics. But we are less good at describing deviation and statistical significance. Either the blog post doesn't give the information, although it should, or results, for example, at NUTS 3 level are never blogged about because some of the results are insignificant. So in this respect, the blog is not so good at describing accuracy. When it comes to comparability and coherence, the statistical quality reports more or less speak about how statistics could be compared. In the blog, we show examples. We show that you can compare the statistics within the European Union. We show the FAO statistics. We can show the neighboring countries and so on. But on the other hand, also perhaps creative comparisons might blur the statistics and it could be seen as naive if we, for example, show how many sheep per person there is in different municipalities. It is a little bit funny, perhaps, and some newspapers write about it, but perhaps it doesn't give credibility to the statistics. And to sum up then, what about trust? What can it contribute? A more personalized voice that some literature say builds trust. We can explain the statistics a little bit more informal. We can sort of show ideas of how the statistics can be used outside our own field where we are responsible for the dissemination. We have also a fairly fast and informal channel to correct misunderstandings or to lead the users into the right track. But it's still portional. Publication bias, I learned yesterday. It's faster, so it's less proofreading and more possibilities for errors. And also, of course, a blog might be seen as less trustworthy than an official web page. Well, that was my summary, so thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much. Related to blogs, and now we are coming to the second presentation. I would like Faiza Suhail from Statistics Finland. Collaboration with universities, a way to promote innovation and experimental culture at statistical offices. So, Faiz, floor is yours.
Statistics Finland has had collaboration with universities for more than 20 years. One essential part of this collaboration is what we call for a thesis trainee program. This program has been a huge success. It has resulted in an active and lively dialogue with the academia. Many good theses have been written as a result of this program, and we have been able to recruit talented people to my office. My main message, however, is that this kind of collaboration is an excellent way to promote innovation and experimental culture at your offices. I believe that the practices I'm about to present are universal in the sense that they can be easily copied and implemented in any statistical office. Within the next few minutes, I'll explain how our collaboration works and, in particular, how it promotes innovation and experimental culture. It all starts with coming up with potential research problems. The first step is to organize an informal brainstorming session where our staff members can suggest themes for master's theses. The idea is to identify interesting data sets that could be analyzed further, to come up with social phenomena or areas where more information and more thorough analysis is requested, or to identify very practical day-to-day challenges on which better methods or better practices would be welcomed. As a result of these brainstorming exercises, a very preliminary list of suggestions is drafted, and this is when the collaboration with the academia steps in. With the help of the professors we collaborate with, these very preliminary suggestions are transformed into mature research problems. I claim that the whole process of coming up with these research problems, research questions itself, promotes innovation and experimental culture. There are so many questions, so many issues at our office that we would like to dig into, but we can't really find the resources and time to do so. The opportunity to appoint a student to work on such problems engages our staff in research and development. It kind of encourages them to think about their work on a wider scope, not just what they produce on a daily or weekly or monthly basis, but on a larger scope. Having the professors and academia on board ensures that the problems, the challenges we identify, can actually be discussed within a scientific framework, that it makes sense to write a master's thesis on the problems we identify. Also, this collaboration with the academia and the professors gives us first-hand information of the methods, results, and outcomes from the world of academia that can be useful in the world of official statistics, or at least are worth a try. Once we have a list of mature research problems, problems that are relevant for a statistical office and fulfill the requirements of an academic research question, this list of research topics is given to professors who work at the universities. These professors act as headhunters. They are professors who bring the most talented students and Statistics Finland together. Each year, we appoint a handful of students who work on a given data set and problem. The way we support these students during their half-year internship is very simple. The professor is, of course, responsible for the academic part of the thesis. But then there is this informal steering group of Statistics Finland members. They are people who are interested in the topic, they know the data set, or are somehow curious about what is going on. What we do is we bring the student, the professor, and this informal steering group around the same table. We meet on a regular basis to follow the progress, findings, and results of the thesis, and these discussions are very lively. I have noticed that it's an excellent way to promote innovation and experimental culture at our office. Having excited staff members, engaged staff members, a student who wants to show what he or she can, and an academic supervisor around the same table really promotes lively discussion. We come up easily with further research problems, and we can utilize the information, the findings, the results of the thesis in our project planning, in the way we allocate resources, how we draft project suggestions, etc., etc. So this also contributes a lot to experimental culture. But what are the concrete results, concrete examples, outcomes of this collaboration and this thesis training program? I'll give you a few examples. Many of the methods that nowadays are an essential part of our methodological tool pack have actually been studied by thesis interns. Seasonal adjustment is just one example. By appointing a student to study the effects of a particular method we're about to implement, we get first-hand information on the effects of that method to our estimates. We get to know more about the theoretical background of the particular method, and we can adjust our implementation plans, project resources, and timetables accordingly. And this is an excellent example of experimental culture. First, we run a small experiment using a student and his supervisor as co-workers, and then we adjust our plans accordingly. My favorite example is now casting. During one of these brainstorming sessions, a very practical day-to-day problem was presented, namely how to produce faster yet accurate statistics. People at our office are familiar with our data sets, with our users, but not so much with the latest time series econometric methods and tools. But with the collaboration with universities, this very practical problem was transformed into an academic research question. And not only that, we were also able to find, to headhunt, an excellent student to study this, this problem. I'm very happy to say that now, a few years after 2011, we have found out that the GDP growth rate can be produced as much as 45 days faster without compromising accuracy. Now, that's what I call for innovation. It all started with a brainstorming exercise where people just identified practical day-to-day challenges. It was escalated once we took the professors on board. This practical problem was transferred into an academic research question. We headhunted an excellent student, and that started kind of the innovative avalanche at our office. So that was a nice outcome. Mixed mode data collection raises multiple questions. They were actually discussed this morning in one of the sessions. How many people will respond to mixed mode surveys? Who will respond? The same people who respond to telephone interviews or a different bunch of people? How they will respond? Will we get similar response distributions from phone and web surveys, or is there going to be a mode effect? These questions were raised by our staff members. The questions were then formalized into academic research questions and studied by thesis students. Having staff members who are engaged in implementing mixed mode data collection, a thesis worker, a student, looking at a particular question, and a supervisor giving information, first-hand information from the world of academia, has been very fruitful for this particular project. We have been able to allocate resources to the questions that are the toughest nuts. We have been able to reconsider the timetable of our implementation project. We have been able to utilize the first-hand results from these theses, and we have made great progress because of collaborating with students and professors. As I mentioned, the world of official statistics is a treasure of research problems. Many of them are so interesting that we would like to put time and effort to that, but we really can't find the resources. But luckily, the collaboration with universities, and in particular the thesis trainee program, allows us to appoint students to look at problems we would like to look at, but we really can't find the time to do so. This program and this collaboration allows our staff members to engage in this work as steering group members and active colleagues who give hints and tips to the student when it comes to questions related to data sets or the subject matter domain or day-to-day practices at Statistics Finland. Anyhow, our staff members are involved in research and development because of this collaboration. Salaries in small and large enterprises is just one of the topics that has been studied by our thesis worker an excellent candidate, by the way, for experimental statistics. So this collaboration can also generate ideas and suggestions for experimental statistics. What I want to say is that this kind of collaboration allows for a win-win-win situation. For a statistical office, this kind of collaboration is an excellent way to promote innovation and experimental culture, as I hopefully have presented. For the students, it allows an excellent start for their career and first-hand experience on using empirical data. And for universities, in particular professors, it allows them to attract students to their seminars and their master programs, and the professors can argue that they collaborate with relevant stakeholders. So everybody wins. The best point here is that I believe that these practices are universal in the sense that you can all easily copy and implement these practices in your offices. And now I challenge you to join me in spreading this message. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for a very optimistic, inspiring, and giving some also hints for the others. I believe that those two teams who won the competition, European Statistics Competition, will join your program, I think, what you said. Okay, so now we are coming to the third presentation, Kamel Gadouche from the GENES CSAD, which is Data Center. He will talk about how widening access to researchers has improved and can continue to improve microdata quality, from national experiences to European aspects. So, Kamel, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry, I don't get the mouse. It's a good start for me. May I? Maybe I can try to. Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. I'm Kamel Gadouche. I'm the director of the French Research Data Center in France, and CSD, which stands for Centre d'accès sécurisé aux données. I will try to show you how widening access to confidential microdata for the research community can increase the level of quality of microdata. So, as you know, it's obvious, but statisticians in France and in Europe produce high quality microdata to issue statistics. microdata, to produce this, it costs a lot of money and a lot of efforts. So widening access is a means to make it more profitable and more studies can be carried out with the researchers and not only by statisticians. The question is, why including external users, such as researchers, in the process increases the quality of microdata. And I can tell you our experience. Before 2010, there was no access to confidential microdata, to the more detailed microdata for researchers. So the statisticians, the data producers, collected and processed microdata for only for their own needs, own use. So what we saw is that the documentation was, when it exists, was not so so good as we can expect. And they can't get feedback from external users which can help to improve the quality of the microdata. And in some cases, data producers told us that getting some suggestions from the research community to improve the survey, to add questions, or to manage new variables from administrative data could help to improve the microdata definition. And one key point is about archiving minute. In some cases, rarely, no offense, but some data sources, especially administrative data, has been lost because it was not archived. So it was really, in some cases, it was a big issue not getting the data, especially because publications were issued from this data, but we couldn't find the data. A few words about methodology, and the generic statistical business process model. It's a model for defining the services needed to produce statistics issued by UNEC, described a whole process of this. I will show you just in a minute. And for the metadata management, the quality of metadata management, there is an international standard, data documentation initiative. And what really changed is that it was in the DDI, Data Documentation Initiative, in version 2, was a codebook, and it moved to a life cycle to take it into account the whole process of producing statistics from the idea to the dissemination and archiving process. So the concept, from the concept to the analysis on the right, including archiving, and that is exactly the same for the GSBPM, the model, and you can see that from the needs, identifying the needs to the evaluation and dissemination phase. All has to be taken into account. So the processes, at design time, it's good to involve researchers, as I said earlier, to discuss the questions, the survey, or the content of administrative files. And it's good to have feedback. Maybe we could add more information on the files, on the data sets, or with good discussions with researchers. But at dissemination time also, you could if you don't have a good documentation, you will have a lot of questions from researchers to ask because they want to know why this variable is defined like this and so on. So data producers have to take in mind that their data will be used by external users. And also, for the metadata, it's true, but it's also true for the microdata itself, because they can make comment on it. And for example, they can find some hidden mistake, or they can help to improve the microdata producing phase, during the microdata producing phase. Just quickly, I will briefly present the French Research Data Center. As I said, we provide access to confidential microdata. We have to protect the access to confidential microdata. So I liked these pictures because it describes exactly what we do. It's researchers in chemistry working on an equipment, and that's exactly what we do, except that it's not a chemistry product, it's for microdata, confidential microdata. And if you want to compare what we do, in this case, researchers is identified, and she can see the product, so that's the same for the data. She has to put her hands in gloves to handle the data, and she gets tools to do everything, and the data remains inside the hermetically sealed chamber. That's exactly what we do at CSD. And for the gloves, that is our gloves. researchers use this device, which is a small computer, a secured computer dedicated for the access with a biometric sensor and a smart card reader, so that they can connect remotely. That's the main difference with the previous picture. And they can then get access to the hermetically sealed chamber where the data is stored, and data must remain inside this chamber. We install all the tools needed, and nothing can be inserted or extracted without someone checking the output or the input. The SD-Box is the only means of access. So there is a specific procedure to get access to confidential data, including which involve Statistics Confidentiality Committee and the Data Protection Authority. So from 2010, we got more and more microdata, not only statistics microdata, but also administrative microdata from the Ministry of Finance, Justice, and so on. From 2 or 3 years, we provide access to health microdata. So we have an increasing demand from the research community. As you can see in this diagram, more and more publications involve microdata, confidential microdata. And I think it stopped in 2014, but now it should be around 60% of the publications involving confidential microdata. So we provide access to 1,500 researchers all across Europe, and including Poland. Here we have some access points in Poland, and we have many, I didn't put every transnational projects, but we have more and more transnational projects involving research teams from different countries working on microdata. Some studies, I will skip it fast because time is running, but we have more than 600 studies that are carried out inside the hermetically sealed chamber. And you have the list in our website, csd.eu. You can get the list, and we also have studies in health field. So, the benefits. As you can see, we get a better documentation now, because now data producers have in mind that their data will be reused by researchers. So now we are working on projects to improve microdata and to unify the microdata, the metadata, the metadata. So researchers are involved in the process of producing metadata, and we also carry out projects on IT projects, IT application for documentation, to share the documentation around the different stakeholders. We have a better management of researchers' feedback, because at the beginning of the project, we didn't get all the feedback from the researchers. Now we are improving this process. And we have a better archiving system, because we have a new rule. Now, when a data set has to be issued to researchers, it has to be archived before. So we still need to improve this organization, but we started this process. At European level, I will go very fast, but we have a wide access to scientific use files, but a limited access to European secure use files because it's a physical safe center. Many countries before France have set up safe centers, and we are working on a transnational project, a core network for research data centers, of research data centers, a collaboration project between United Kingdom, Germany, France, and Netherlands. That's the picture. We are trying to build links between all the research data centers. And in conclusion, I can say it's obvious, but improving quality is a continuous process. The research community can be involved, deeply involved in the process, and there's still a lot of work in France, but we started, so we get some results now. And it's the reason why I think the European Statistics Code of Practice includes sections about providing access to external users and especially researchers. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much for widening opportunities to work in the area of data research center. And now we are coming to Vice President Carsten Zangenberg from Statistics Denmark. I understand this is joint work with colleagues, and the topic is quality in statistics in relation to the present media. So floor is yours.
Thank you. My name is Carsten Zangenberg. I'm director in Statistics Denmark for the areas of communication, but also for methodology and quality and analysis, and then also for our commercial business, which are rather big, relatively big in Denmark. I have made this presentation together with one of our journalists in Statistics Denmark, Magnus, who knows more about the media than I do, and also have a future in, for instance, the national broadcast company in Denmark. Yes. But so we made this together, and I will try to see it from inside of a statistical agency and outside, from the media's world.
We have like 2 minutes to open the presentation, okay?
Yes, thank you.
It's not
yes.
Working. Yeah, we need like
no, okay, one. It's locked.
Yeah, it's still locked.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Somebody's here.
You can do it with the
we have some computer problems here.
I can do it. I can. Which one?
I can't.
Which one?
Carsten, yes, this one.
Have to do with the keyboard.
Okay.
And I think that this could work.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your patience. So we'll just start. And this one I have modified for this day because of this conference and you as audience, because back home I used to say that quality of the statistical product is not what you put into it, but I modified it now today. Because what I think actually is the quality of a product is what the user get out of it. Many of you know this concept about the reality and the conceptual reality and how we present it. I think a lot of our challenges is that our understanding and our possible understanding of the reality maybe not are the same as our users' understanding of the reality. A good question is always why we are here, and as a national statistic agency, we used to say that we provide the facts for the society. We made the reference frame of the facts, and we make the reference points of the facts. And we used to say that we actually are one of the, you know, pillars of the democracy in the Western world. But what I think most statistical agencies are facing these years are a lot of changing. We heard it all this morning, but beside the change of our external world and our users' world, I think we are challenged with restricting budget, new data which are very hard to get. Sometimes we have to pay for it. We are challenged by recruiting new young talents. The economy is getting very hot in Denmark, and the wage in the private sector, for instance, for data scientists, are much higher than we are allowed to pay. That was just examples that how the world are changing, but the world outside is also changing. And we saw some of this morning about the competition of the market of facts. I think Konrad explained a lot of these social medias and how they are getting to be, they're actually, I think you can say Facebook in Denmark, I think it's about 30% of the adult population who are using Facebook as a news media. But besides what we heard this morning, I would say we have the Internet of Things. We have a lot of devices actually who actually made statistics, unedited statistics, which are getting used in a broad way. But what we also face in Denmark, I can say this is things and interest organizations, and I also put some ministers there, who actually are producing statistics. But I will say they are also producing statistics with another purpose than we are as a national statistical agency. And then I will not say any more.
So with this competition in the market of facts, this means, as we see it in Statistics Denmark, that the media becomes an even increasingly a key agent for us to put out our figures into the public sphere. That's where the political discussion is going on. That's where we want to put our numbers, our figures, to be a key reference frame. But the thing is, this used to be quite simple. The media called us and we gave them some figures, but for the media, the world is changing as well. They see, as we see, pressure from other competitors. Social media they are competing with as well. This leads to cuts in resources and cuts in staffs, and we see journalists have to produce more and more articles every day. And we see a tendency in the media to follow the easiest stories, which means that the media will seek for more contextualized figures. That's what think tanks that Carsten mentioned are very good at. But it means that if we want to meet the media's new demands, we also need to be more closer to the context in the media and to the media agenda. We might want to be more proactive in pushing our figures to the media, and we want to have less production time and better production timing in terms of what Anne-Marie said. When the journalists want to use the numbers, that's the timing I'm saying here. But this new, more proactive approach also means that we are trying to get the attention from new recipients that's not that used to statistical work, and it means that we have to approach the quality issues in a new way. The thing is, can we handle this? And it's a question for Carsten.
Actually, we tried, and we tried also at a strategic level with two initiatives, which we will come back to. We set up an analyzed unit who should go more in depth and more broad on the statistical domains. And actually, we inspired by CBS in Netherlands, we try to have this editorial board who met every morning and see what's up today in the news. Besides that, we have a lot of initiatives about going out to training journalists, building metadata system, coherent metadata system, incentive work on documentation and on reviews or quality reviews on different statistical domains every year. A few words about the analytical unit. We set it up two, three years ago, with three men and two students. Now we also recruit a postdoc student, but they are an inspiration for all the statistical work in Statistics Denmark. And they try to go deeper and broader, try to inspirate the staff, and then they made their own allies beside this, also to try to inspire it.
Another branch of this effort is the editorial setup. That's where I spend most of my working hours. Back home in Copenhagen, I'm the editor of the day, the one on duty, whose job is to identify stories in the media's agenda that we want to intervene, or at least push figures into that make sense. Then two other main characters in this setup is the output editor, is the one deciding which stories we want to follow, and the input editor, that's kind of the link between the dissemination team and the statistical officers. This guy has he's from the analysis unit, actually, and he has a key role in evaluating the quality of the different statistics that we want to use in certain contexts in the media. A short example of what we could do is the Minister of Justice in Denmark wanted to raise the punishment for robberies at home. We showed a graph that showed that the number of home robberies had actually fallen during the past 10 years, I think. We also did a short article that's, I think, close to the blog that Anne-Marie told about. This article was about subsidies to farmers in Denmark. We did this when the European Union had to discuss their new long-term budget last month. It showed that the subsidies and the revenue for farmers in Denmark was actually quite the same. We have different criteria that we want to meet when we put figures into the public debate. We have the new value, meaning that the figures that we put into the story has to make new value to the agenda going on in the media. The story in the media has to meet certain news criteria. That basically means that we follow the more important stories and the less sensation-driven stories. We don't react to celebrity stories, an example. And also we have to be very careful that the figures that we decide to put into a certain context can actually bear to be discussed in this particular context. Even though we put quite a lot of effort into to this quality issue, we have had to deal with different examples of misinterpretations in the media. This is three examples that have different character. We won't go into them right here. They're not all from the editorial setup. One is a revision of the national accounting example, but it shows that we have new recipients and we have to discuss quality in a new way. And the thing is, how we do it. Oh, sorry.
By the communication and dissemination, going one or two steps forward into the debate, we discovered new problems. And actually, though we have worked with our quality and documentation a lot in Statistics Denmark, we discovered new problems. I mean, there's another prize, and maybe a prize we didn't see before we started this, on the quality work. So you can say going out with analyses, going out with specific tweets on, you know, day-to-day items, have given us different kind of problems, as Magnus said. So how are we trying to avoid this? How are we trying to deal with this? is trying to work with context-based documentation. We have to go to the documentation once more. It's not good enough for how we are using, because now we're using it hard. So we can see that the way we produce it, using it soft, is not that good anymore for our users. And then we have to be much more transparent. But being transparent have also a cost for all the statistical domains in our house. But I hope at the minutes we have after, maybe some of you also have some good ideas for people like us trying to dare to go out to the debate in the society as a statistical agency. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. So we're looking forward to some messages from the audience after last presentation. Last but not least, Alessandro Martinisi from Breda University of Applied Sciences. And the topic is dimensions of quality statistics in news, strengths and weaknesses. Now we see how do we start with this.
So I should calendar window here. Voila.
It's working okay.
Am I right? Yes. And then this one. So good afternoon, everybody. I have to say thank you to Statistics Poland to allow a non-statistician to even step in. I'm not a statistician, I'm a former journalist who turned into academia, and I soon became aware how important is quantitative information and quantitative data, and especially in storytelling. So what I'm going to share with you this afternoon is part of some of the results of a project I conducted back in the UK about the articulation of statistics, in particular quality statistics, in the major newspapers, UK newspapers. So one of the key points I wanted to highlight with my project was the dichotomy between the normative and professional aspirations of journalism that statistics can help underpin the quality of news, and the desire to strengthen the ability of storytellers, namely journalists, to persuade audiences by means of numbers. To this end, the research I conducted back in the UK examined tensions and issues around the articulation of statistics and numbers in the practice of journalism, and in doing so has pinpointed trust in news as the central aspect of such tensions. Although initially the concept of trust was not at the center of my analysis, it gradually became so, not only in terms of the gap between journalists' reports and news audiences' perceptions, but also in relation to the ability of journalists to tell stories using data-driven argumentation and ultimately numbers. One of the key aims of my research was to improve our understanding of the use of statistics as a primary means for the construction of journalistic quality. And I wanted to focus on areas such as crime and health in the UK. In this context, the findings of my research confirmed that the use journalists make of statistics plays a crucial role in the construction of both social reality and readers' perception of public affairs. The research also examined and wanted to emphasize how journalists engage with numbers in the journalistic practice of quality storytelling. At the center of my analysis is the link between the articulation of statistics and the ability to produce quality news. Hence, the research project embraced quality as a central aspect. And I applied the quality framework, the statistical quality framework, to the journalistic, to the news. As you can see from this table, I've drawn the five major quality dimensions. We can be overlapped with the five quality dimensions of statistics. So there is a link between quality journalism as decline in five dimensions and quality statistics. And I would say that in the same way, journalists and statisticians share the same mission of related to public good and public good service. I conducted a content analysis of almost 500 newspaper articles from the Guardian, the Daily Mail, the Times, the Observer, related Sunday editions. And well, this pentagonal approach enabled me basically to assess the nature of the critical engagement and explore how journalists engage with statistics in order to successfully incorporate every single dimension and analyze how statistics can help to achieve such dimensions, in single dimensions. So I will share with you only part of my project, which is, as I said before, the content analysis of 500 newspaper articles. And I'm going to start with with an overview of the newspaper sample, which you can see from this pie chart. The Guardian, and it's a Sunday edition, the Observer makes heavy use of statistics in their news related to health and crime, followed by the Daily Mail, the Times, and ultimately the Daily Mirror and the Sunday Mirror. But as far as the five quality dimensions are concerned, let me start with the first one, which is relevance. So statistics should be used to make stories relevant, right, to the readers, by adding a human interest as a way of contextualizing isolated events into a wider societal context. In this sense, my findings show that newspapers have different strategies when using statistics to humanize their data-driven stories. And in the Daily Mail, in the Daily Mirror, and the Times, statistics appear to be at the center of the stories as the core of the argument. Whether in the Guardian, statistics are instead used to substantiate the story and to make the particular news story part of a wider societal problem. Indeed, there are different ways to articulate the dimension of relevance to deliver quality news. And this is in accordance with some news values and some deontological values as well. But the data I collected indicated a certain type of statistics are relevant in health news, while crime news tend to use other kind of statistics. So contrary to my initial expectations, the overall result in this particular dimension show that relevance is, there is no evidence that relevance is used to achieve quality. Second dimension is the accuracy. Well, in the journalism studies, the literature is wide related to journalism accuracy, and accuracy should play a pivotal role in news production. For every journalism, with no exception. However, in terms of verification, which is one of the key variables I used to assess this particular quality dimension, I found that an overwhelming 98% of statistical reports are neither verified nor questioned. The statistics are not verified, nor the journalists use statistics to verify other sources. This means that journalists rely And here I'm aware that I'm walking into a very crucial floor here, especially in this context. Rely exclusively on official data without a proper critical engagement that the art of journalism and the verification of journalism would apply. And obviously this kind of attitude clashes with some deontological duty of verifying, as I said before, the sources, which is one of the most globally accepted ethical norms that keeps the journalistic profession cohesive among cultures. And statistics obviously are supposed to increase the accuracy of news, but without proper verification, well, or cross-referencing with other statistical sources, the achievement of this particular dimension, accuracy dimension, remains at a purely and merely theoretical level. Timeliness. Well, the dimension of timeliness has been mentioned before in keynote speech, in the keynote this morning by the head of statistical Austria. He mentioned about a type two user who are the journalists who are most interested in quick and dirty data to tell a story. Yes, timeliness, according to my results, show that the statistics often come from statistical reports more than 3 months old, especially in the case of medicine and health. And this contradicts common assumptions and claims that journalists do not have enough time to evaluate and give sufficient consideration to numbers, but actually they have time, more than three months is enough time to assess the timeliness of any statistical reports. And in almost 40% of the articles, statistical information is used to substantiate stories and other been assertions made by journalists. Well, as you can see also from the data, the 38% is completely unknown. There is no mention of the year of the statistical reports and statistical release. I'm gonna quick jump to the fourth and fifth dimension, interpretability, the words of numbers. By this, I meant a good verbalization of the technical vocabulary and terminology typical of statistics and mathematics. This is an ongoing struggle that journalists face on a daily basis, how to make statistics, the verbalization of statistics, properly verbalized using a down-to-earth terminology. And accessibility, looking behind the curtains, the analysis show that there is an over-reliance mainly on, especially for what concerns the Guardian Observer, on one source only, and mainly government reports and official reports. This speaks volumes about how the attitude of journalists that tend to walk the safest route and report more official statistics rather than non-official statistics. If this is a problem, then I will leave this consideration, this debate, to academics in the field and journalists in the field. Flow shows my area of intervention, which occurred in between X2 and C3. So when the statistical agency delivers the report and the newsroom. So it happens at the moment where journalists inside the newsroom basically are engaged with the statistical reports. So to come to an end, through the lenses of the five dimensions chosen at the beginning of my study as a threshold for achieving quality, I observed that journalists engage with numbers in a reactive rather than a proactive way. They tend to report, at least as a health and crime report, crime statistics are concerned, they tend to report passively statistics without that kind of critical engagement that the profession of journalism requires, the kind of skeptical attitude that the journalistic profession requires. But also, as I mentioned here, but I won't go into detail now, I identified three areas as well, which is the three A's, I call it, the three A's of distrust, which are authority, accessibility, and accuracy, which I assessed through a focus group that I conducted always back in the UK between Manchester, Liverpool, and Leeds. To wrap up this intervention, I would say that where do we go from here? From some of my qualitative data, sure, there is a quality culture that we need to address. Journalist interview didn't show any kind of awareness of what quality is and what quality means, even though they identified the drivers, the factors that could lead to equality conceived as a completeness of information. But obviously, there is a lot of work to do to improve this quality knowledge and this quality culture among the journalistic community. And last but not least, statistical literacy, statistical knowledge and research methods, which still, at least back in the UK, faces some problems apply courses in statistics at the university level, at least for what concern journalism studies specifically. So this is a second area that absolutely needs to be addressed. So I hope that this can be translated also into a European context more broadly. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. So now we still have some time, maybe 15 minutes, a little bit more for discussion. We got very nice balance of the papers for these two areas that are in the title of our session, which is on one hand collaboration with the scientific community, on the other hand communication with users, especially through media. So I would invite you for the questions, for some maybe hints, some remarks. They can be directed to anybody, except for me, of course, from the panel. But also can be very general questions, maybe. Okay, I think that we have a microphone there. So if you can also ask a question just to introduce yourself, it will be very nice. Okay, go on.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Jacek Maślankowski, University of Gdańsk and Statistics Poland. I've got a few questions to Faiz because it was very interesting presentation. So as far as I understood, if you have any research problem, you are going to the university and then collaborate with a group of students selected by professors. So my first question is, what is the selection criteria to go to the specific professor? And the second question, do you just cooperate with the university in Helsinki or maybe other universities? And the third question, did you think about creating something like a network of experts in which researchers can apply to cooperate with the specific research problems with Statistics Finland? So my three questions.
You can answer right now. Yeah, probably there were three questions. So go ahead, please.
Okay. So for the selection criteria, we basically have a gentleman's agreement with the professors we particularly collaborate with, is that they suggest or introduce talented students to us. And we leave it to the professors to evaluate who is a talented and who's, say, excited about working at Statistics Finland. The second question was about whether we collaborate with the University of Helsinki or other universities. Currently, we collaborate only with the University of Helsinki. In the past, we had collaboration also with another university called the University of Jyväskylä, which is located in the center of Finland. We have not considered having like a group of researchers to collaborate with. Basically, the dilemma we have is that we consider students as, or we don't consider students as researchers. So we appoint them, they work as Statistics Finland staff members while they are at our premises, which makes them like a different group of people than researchers who pay to get access to our microdata sets. So this is like a way to avoid the kind of situation where certain researchers would be having access to data for free and others would have to pay for it.
Okay, more questions? Yes, please.
Thank you. I'm Ineke Stoop. I'm the chair of the European Statistical Advisory Committee representing users. And I really liked Alessandro Martinisi's presentation about journalism. And I just wonder, if you read in a newspaper a general article and it's mentioned that the unemployment rate in a country is like 5% or 7% or whatever, as a background information, then it's okay. But when there is a background study on what you call unemployment or employment not measured by unofficial statistics or whatever, you would really appreciate this general attitude of what does it mean, delving into the data, finding out what it is. So I think depending on the type of journalism, the type of article you would really want to, okay, this is the data and we're not going to discuss it. Or really, we have to figure out what it all means. So could you distinguish between these two different types of journalism?
Thank you. Works, yes. Well, there are different types, as you said before, different types of journalism, especially you can distinguish beat reportage, for example, or features writing. And everything related to, the research I conducted was particularly related to crime and health statistics. So I didn't take into account, for example, financial journalism, that is a very broad area and broad subject that it actually is worth to explore more in depth. The kind of statistics you want to convey as a journalist, it would be to inform, to conform with the normative values, which is to inform the public. Okay, this would be the main goal, the ultimate end, I would say. And your question opens up a huge debate around. How journalists manipulate statistics for the good or for the bad. So I don't really want to go in such details because we don't have the time to develop this kind of discussion. But for sure, is related to as briefly as you said before. To a kind of writing style you want to adopt, a kind of news reporting, kind of style of news reporting you want to apply. So you have a feature of writings that might make use of a kind of a certain type of statistics or like opinions-led news stories that make use other kind of statistics, and make use also of a different type of verbalization of data. So all this kind of different stylistic reportages are to be taken into consideration, distinction. So, yeah, you want to?
Just a supplement. I think also we should be aware of a third type of journalist. We call them data journalists in Denmark. There's not much of many of these yet, but they are getting educated and they work in quite another way. Not in all newspapers, but in some newspapers. In Denmark, it's the Tablet newspaper who had the biggest group of this data journalist, but their interest are not our stories, but that is a system like the Carmel system, getting direct access to this or the research service systems at the statistical agencies.
Actually, data-driven journalism is also includes the big data, okay, big data data set. But what I've taken into consideration is more the mathematical purely applied statistics rather than the new branded type of journalism, which is a data-driven journalism. So it's a rather different perspective to the same topic.
I was talking about manipulation, purposeful.
Yeah, well, manipulation is a polysemantic word, isn't it? So.
Okay, some other, yes, please.
So I have a question for Anne-Marie and for Alessandro. Alessandro, you mentioned almost all of the articles were non-critical. That's my impression as well in the Danish context. But you said that 2% of the articles were actually critical, and that's the 2% that fills up the working hours in the statistical institute. That's at least my impression. We only need one or two articles, and we have to work on them for several days. So could you elaborate a bit on those 2%? And for Anne-Marie, you do a blog that looks a bit like we have a communication channel in Denmark. We call it Behind the Numbers. And it's a less personal tone, but it kind of has the same aim, I think. So have you had any examples of blogs that you have put out that has turned into a critical situation for you and being met by critique? I'm very keen to hear about one or two examples if it's possible. Thank you.
Who comes first?
Where we've had critique is once again the meat consumption, because it's a very sensitive area. And you know, we have slaughter weight, which means, of course, that when we give a figure of meat consumption per person, it is perhaps twice as much as you actually put on the fork into your mouth. And that is something we try to explain, but some will still misunderstand it, and then we got a lot of critique because we are exaggerating the meat consumption. It takes a lot of time to deal with. And what we've tried to do is, once again, to be as clear as we possibly can. And always when we write about meat consumption, we sort of add this dimension.
I think there was...
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the question. In terms of criticism, I made a distinction when I done the content analysis into factual, practical, scholarly criticism. In both three areas, these three types of criticism were not applied. So a different kind of criticism, and I made a distinction based on the literature review available. In all the three, on these three kinds of criticism that also are applied into the much more philosophical aspect and applied into more in a journalistic flow as well, they were not satisfied.
This might be slightly leading, but when we meet critique in this National Statistical Institute in Denmark, it's usually because journalists are kind of holding up the critique. It's usually other parties that kind of draw the attention to a potential critique to journalists, and then the journalists start to get critical about our figures and the context we push them into. It might just be a remark. It's not really a question.
Okay, any other questions? Yes, there's one more, please.
Markus Bönisch from Statistics Austria. A question to the Danish colleague. So I've seen Statistics Denmark got more actively involved in the public debate. So this was more or less a change of role, I guess. How was the reaction on that from a political side and also from the general public? And another thing that would interest me is, how is the decision taken? This is now an issue where we have to react as a national agency, or this is a statement from a politician where we have to act?
Thank you for the question. And this has actually been an issue for the management of the Statistics Denmark, what to do here. And we had a lot of official hearings putting up the analyze unit for ministers, for the medias, and for the interest organization. And what I can say rather clear is that the media is very happy for what we are doing, because actually we are helping them and helping their jobs. For the interest organization, you can say the interest organization who also make their own quantitative analysis, they were a bit worried. But they were worried because we were going into a field where, I mean, they have a kind of monopoly. And now we will come as, you know, an agency with a crown at our logo, and it could make their life a little more difficult. And for some of the central ministers, the answers was, that is a good idea, but we should be very careful with our trustability. And we are, actually. But what I can say is that we haven't really had any problem with the analyzers, which actually are the most hard tool to go out in this field or getting this step before. What we have the hard critics on was our new series called Behind the Figures, where we make very short articles day to date on actual issues. And what we have been criticized for, beside what we showed before, not communicating the quality in a proper way for the user group, it have been related to the time, to the timing of our publishing. We have a situation where we have published some relevant figures while there was some political parties discussing in a closed room. We didn't knew that, but we find out very short after that they don't find it proper that this National Statistical Agency are going out with figures while they are sitting trying to find a political solution in a closed room. So actually we changed our criteria, going a little bit back, and said if there's, you know, specific political discussions going on, we'll wait to afterwards coming out with the, you know, specific figures on that, but we don't go back. So the reaction have been rather positive, but with some small peaks, especially on the competitors in the market.
Maybe. Just to elaborate on Carsten's remark, it is a criteria for us that when we enter a new story, with these quite, sometimes it's only a tweet, it's a very short communication. We always try to at least think about if this is figures that can be understood and argued upon from different political views, so we don't just help one side of the political spectrum, because in many situations numbers can be used on all different, from all different political perspectives. So it is definitely an issue for us also on a daily basis.
Yes, actually, I think we are coming to the end of the session, if I can look at the time. And so I would like to congratulate and thank all presenters. Thank you very much for your contribution. And also all discussants, and for also you that you come here. And we try to keep the balance between these two topics, although communication with media started to be more hot in our discussion. So thank you very much. And I believe, do we have any announcement, or we just go for a, yeah, just to announce?
Just two sentences. Please check all your belongings are with you when you are leaving. And we've got the coffee break on the first floor now. Thank you very much.